You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
When my next guest was full-time at 91 in Cape Town, he consults to them now, incidentally, we spoke fairly often, and he always added a certain gravitas, and dare I say, elan, to my podcast. And he's back now in the guise as a contributor to the Daily Maverick, the excellent Daily Maverick, and it's Michael Power. Michael Power, I've missed you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Lindsay. Long time no speak. Too long time no speak.
Yes, and we'll rectify that right now and in the future, I hope. Now, an article on wind power and other renewables caught my eye. That was your last contribution to Daily Maverick. And it sort of coincided with an ad campaign on Dutch television for a company called Vattenfall. It's a wind power company, and it engaged the services of Samuel L. Jackson. And at the beginning, he said, he said a rude word, and then he said wind farms, loud, ugly, and harmful to nature. And then rather whimsically, he said, now, who said that? And of course, he's talking about Donald Trump. And that is a big theme in your article.
Indeed, it is. Although I use a slightly more eloquent way of introducing it. I talk about Don Quixote on his nag, Rocinante, tilting his lance at windmills and calling them monsters. But truly, we haven't really progressed much from that.
No, we haven't. What I really need to know, well, you're going to give us the detail, because there's a lot of detail in your article, a lot of statistics and comparisons, etc., particularly between the United States and China. But what Trump has done, is it disastrous for the renewables movement? And perhaps you could tell us what he's done as well.
Well, I think that, I mean, at the most basic level, he has given in to the oil lobby. And I think that, I mean, he is in hock to the oil lobby, probably because they supplied a lot of money for his re-election. I also think that it just fits neatly with his own almost antiquarian thinking on where the US is. And he has this sort of rather naive belief that we can go back to, I'm not sure if it's the 1950s or the 1850s, but one of them. And somehow that this sort of almost glorious world that was existing then and portrayed on television and the like can somehow be restored. It's just, you know, it's tilting at windmills. He is in cloud cuckoo land. And the Chinese are laughing all the way to the wind bank. And I'm afraid the United States is heading for a really bad reckoning. It's quite sad to watch, particularly since I have a fleeting admiration for the old US that was. But I'm afraid I don't have that admiration any longer.
Yes, he has a fleeting admiration for the Rockefeller era, of course, you know, digging
holes. I'm a great fan of the first Roosevelt, who was a Republican who took on the Rockefellers of the world. That's my, I know he's not without his bad side, but early Roosevelt was a remarkable individual.
The United States produces 21 million barrels of oil a year. That's opposed to the Saudis, who produce 11 million. Why is it so important that the American mix goes more in favor of renewables and away from fossil fuels, Michael?
Well, first of all, renewables are incredibly cheap. Indeed, the feedstock is free. You don't pay for wind, you don't pay for water, and you definitely don't pay for sunshine. And all of those arrive on your doorstep, and you just have to make the most of them. You don't have to dig them out of the ground like you do with oil or gas, and that can be extremely expensive. In fact, I think that break-even rate for most of the shale projects in the United States is about $60 a barrel. So first of all, it's much, much cheaper. Once you've got it up and running and you've borne the costs of establishment, the running costs are incredibly low. It's then also because the Chinese have come up with this incredible thing called ultra-high voltage transmission, which sounds incredibly boring, but basically it allows them to transport electricity to 3,000 kilometers without basically losing any along the way. Previously, you were broadly restricted to about 150 kilometers from the point of generation before it became economic to send it further. The Chinese have completely overcome that problem. And the result is they've got these two massive deserts in the northwest of China called the Gobi, which we all know of, and then the Taklamakan, which is almost as big as the Gobi, which are both sun traps and wind traps. And they've just set up an enormous array of turbines and solar panels there. And they are just bringing in enormous amounts of electricity as a result to the East Coast.
Well, this is very interesting, Michael. Sorry to interrupt. This then means that the floating wind farms that have been mooted for quite a while now can be a reality. You can stick these things out into the wildest waters of the Atlantic and the Pacific and transport electricity back. I mean, that's what it sounds like.
In fact, the largest wind turbine in the world is offshore of China. And you and I will appreciate the reference. It has a diameter that is 3.5 rugby fields wide.
Good Lord. That's enormous.
Enormous. Now, take it one stage further and be quite boring and engineering about it. The amount of materials technology that was required in order to be able to withstand the torque that is generated from that monster turning round, you know, they basically had to reinvent metal, which they've done, in order to be able to get this thing to stand up there and indeed withstand hurricanes and tornadoes and the rest of it, which it's done so.
Yeah. Okay, so the future is renewables, and Donald Trump is obviously not the future. Rather, Donald Trump's policy is not the future. And I look at my electricity bill every month. It's not particularly low, but I look at it anyway, and it's broken down. It tells me where I get my power from. Number one is wind, number two is solar, and number three is biomass. So there's no coal or nuclear or anything involved there. And I wonder when the United States will ever get to that sort of position, Michael.
Well, look, it was traveling in that direction in a higgledy-piggledy sort of way. And indeed, you know, Joe Biden would have probably pushed it further, or any Democrat would have pushed it further. The oil lobby in the United States is still unbelievably powerful, regardless of whether it's Democrats or Republicans that are running the place. There is this delusion that somehow, just because we've become, you know, the world's largest oil and gas producer, that somehow, you know, we've nailed the energy problem. They've actually, obviously, because of all sorts of eco considerations, they've compounded it. But it comes back to the basic point that the cost of that energy is so much higher than it would be for wind or solar, or indeed hydro, which the Chinese are doing some extraordinary things as well.
The sort of example that you've given of the deserts in China, where only, and I'm not being facetious here, well, actually I am, where only a few lizards will be squashed with these windmills being plonked into the sand or the rock or whatever it is, can't be applied to a lot of other countries. For example, a sunny country like South Africa, because of the pristine environment across most of the country.
Well, actually, it is being applied to South Africa. In fact, 2 years ago, and I haven't seen last year's figure, South Africa was the fifth largest importer of wind turbines in the world. So there are vast areas of South Africa, and many of them actually will work through winter as well as summer, like, as you know, the northwest of South Africa,
yeah,
that can actually both host particularly solar, but the West Coast itself is one of the best wind traps in the world. It's basically because it's a west facing across the sea. It's one of those sort of areas like Chile. And the amount of facilities that are now going into the West Coast is quite extraordinary. So, yes, I think South Africa, I mean, I've heard and I've not seen how this has been calculated, but one estimate is that because of the mess up of Eskom a few years ago and the need for us to look at renewables, the renewables that have been installed since that happened have now taken us up to what was called level 6 in terms of load shedding. So we are now covered up to level 6 with renewables, which creates a buffer in South Africa that is quite extraordinary, which is why, touch wood, we don't have load shedding now.
I went off at a tangent because we were supposed to be concentrating on the US versus China. And when we think of the US versus China, we think of AI and we think of military and we think of all sorts of different geopolitical nastinesses. But back to renewables, is it important that the United States catches up even after Trump? And if so, why is it important?
Look, I think that if we want to go back to physics 101, you will know that energy transferred is work. So it is the most basic equation in basically life. You know, this world does not function without sunlight coming in, performing photosynthesis on plants, allowing that to become food for all the species that live here, that then gives us the energy to do what we do. So we need energy. Right. And we need it in vast quantities. And you mentioned AI. One of the ironies of ironies at the moment is that the AI industry in the United States is potentially going to be tripped up because it simply doesn't have enough electricity for what is going to be needed over the next 5 to 10 years. It's probably the Achilles heel of the AI industry in the States. So energy is needed, but it's also being needed. And I think we're moving out of what I would call a petrostate to an electrostate world. And the United States is getting left behind. There are factories now operating in China that are pretty much totally without human involvement. Not, you know, I'd say 99%, but there is one, and you can look it up on YouTube. It's wonderful. It's called the Dark Factory. It's a Xiaomi cell phone manufacturer just outside of Beijing. And it operates without humans. And it produces 10 million handsets a year.
Gosh.
The new BYD factory in Zhengzhou, which will be 10 times the size of the largest factory that Tesla has, 16 production lines, 1 million units, car units per annum, 2 EVs per minute, is entirely run off electricity. So we're moving into this world where electricity is essentially going to power not just industry, but services and life itself. And it's quite clear, looking at the long-term projections, that the carbon is, the age of carbon is moving behind us.
Of course, and the car example is a very good one and a very pertinent one, because BYD is building a factory that is 10 times bigger than anything that Tesla's got now. It means that everyone in China, or the majority of Chinese car owners, will be Chinese electric car owners, and they need electricity, of course.
Well, in 2022, there are 11 million electric cars in China. By the end of this year, there'll be 44 million. That's up, you know, four times in 4 years. That plant that BYD has built is twice the area of downtown San Francisco. It's absolutely massive.
These things, yeah, pass the mainstream media by, don't they, Michael? But they don't pass you by. Now, tell me, the Trump policy, the Trump administration's policy of, you know, removing certain tax breaks and all that sort of thing, is obviously a setback to the renewables industry in the United States of America. But it'll get back when the next president comes in. They'll get back, won't they? They'll claw their way back from the setback.
Yeah, they might. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that, as I said at the outset, you know, there's 1.4 billion Chinese people laughing at what the United States is doing at the moment. They're basically taking time out from the great race of the 21st century. And that is an energy race. It is not an AI race. And just to make the point, doubly make the point, you can't have AI without energy. So get the energy sorted out, and then you can have AI. And they're basically taking time out for 4 years. Yes, they might be able to get back. But as things stand at the moment, China is responsible for 2/3 of all solar and wind installations currently happening. Of the nuclear power stations that are under consideration, there are 65 in the world, 30 of them will be built in China. The hydro capacity, they're just putting in this new dam, which is three times the size of the Three Gorges Dam, and broadly speaking, will be able to match the entire HEP hydroelectric power output of the United States on an annual basis. You know, these numbers, and that's why I, as you saw in the article, completely bludgeoned the reader to death almost with the data. But you just have to, in order to, as you said, the mainstream media doesn't pick up on this, and it just seems to be letting it pass by. Meanwhile, the Chinese are almost delighted the fact that they're not being spotlighted for what it is that they're doing, because they're creeping up and taking over. And in fact, my latest presentation, it says how China has risen to the top of the world of tech without the US or Wall Street realizing it.
What you've described with all the idea of how much electricity they need, Chinese policymakers will sit down and say, we project that we need this amount of electricity in 5, 10, 20 and 50 years' time. And they present it to somebody and they say, OK, do it. There's the desert. Go and stick the wind farms. You can't do that in the United States because of the layers and layers of bureaucracy.
No. And at least, and there's also this other problem is that to some extent, because they're only dribbling the new electricity supply onto the market very slowly, there is a political dimension. I mean, I don't know whether you know, but electricity prices in the United States are rising at quite a material clip above the rate of inflation.
Yes.
And it's becoming a political hot potato now, because basically the data centers that are required to run these large language models are just so power hungry, and they are essentially crowding out you and me. And so electricity prices are just going up. They haven't gone up for 5 years in a row in China. Reason being is, and it goes back to your point, the people who planned all of this have brought on supply to match what they consider to be the rising demand. And broadly speaking, they've done it at, you know, at the right rate. So, yes, you're right. In the United States, they can't do this. And then, of course, you've got, you know, a government that basically is trying to put all sorts of blockages in the way of particularly renewable energy, and then just say, no, don't worry, we'll supply it all by gas and coal and oil, all very eco-friendly. And it's not happening nearly at the rate that is actually required.
You started to write your piece with a point in mind, and you've made many of the points, but can you sum it up for us, please, Michael, what you've said and why what you've said is so important?
In the great race of the 21st century, which is ultimately an energy race, and how the world is transitioning from being petro-states to electro-states, the US is throwing in the towel and China is running away with the winning cup. And it's largely not being appreciated by Western financial media.
Very good. What can we expect next on the pages of Daily Maverick, please?
I'm doing a piece on AI, partly because it just has completely and utterly overwhelmed my inbox, and it's taking up almost 50% of my reading time at the moment. And there's a very interesting and, again, untold story that's beginning to emerge on AI. First of all, if you read most Western financial media, all they talk about is AI as represented in large language models. And that seems to dominate most of their thinking. And that, of course, translates into, you know, NVIDIA being the most valuable company in the world, and the tech element of the Magnificent Seven doing extraordinarily well, and the stock market, you know, reaching new time highs. But actually, there's essentially two in the large language model story. There are two side-by-side philosophies. One which is dominated by the Americans, which is the closed model, or the closed weight model, as it's sometimes called, and the other, which is the open weight model, which of course is dominated by China. And Chinese approach is catching up with the American approach very fast and probably will soon start to overtake it. The interesting thing about the Chinese approach, and there's a good analogy here, it's a bit like Linux. You know, we've almost forgotten about Linux, but it's there in the world of computer software. In fact, I found out yesterday that the top 500 supercomputers in the world are all run on Linux. They have nothing to do with Windows.
I haven't heard the word Linux for years.
Exactly. And it's a fascinating subject once you get into it and look at, I mean, my God, it underpins the world of big computers exclusively. Microsoft does not get a look in. And what is potentially going to happen is a parallel sort of development where open source large language models, which, by the way, don't require as spectacularly sophisticated microchips to be able to operate, nor do they require heavy-duty data centers that consume huge amounts of electricity. They're a much cheaper way to run large language models. And the Chinese are winning hands down. They're winning in the open source or open weight race. The Americans are still winning for now in the closed weight, closed source race. And so it's a fascinating side-by-side tussle that is emerging. Again, not picked up by Western financial media, because there are very few companies that are listed that reflect the open source philosophy. Most of the companies that are listed are either in the closed source area or, like NVIDIA, supplying that area. And it's just going to be oh my God, it's just going to come out of left field. And suddenly, like Linux, people are going to realize that actually there's a vastly cheaper way and more efficient way and less energy intensive way of being able to run large language models. And it doesn't involve necessarily going down the closed route of the Americans.
You'll probably cover this in your article, but does that mean then that if someone says, I don't want to buy NVIDIA because I can't bring myself to buy something that's gone from a dollar to $160, whatever it is now. So there must be Chinese AI-linked companies listed on various exchanges in the Far East.
There are, and there are a couple of players. And if you want to look at one on a chart, look at Cambricon, which is an interesting sort of NVIDIA light option that's potentially emerging in China. And nobody's really heard of it, but it's a fascinating chart. It's one which, you know, almost eclipses NVIDIA in terms of its stratospheric rise. And I worry about stratospheric rises. But the point being is that, no, there are some stories and there are ways of playing the China game, as it were. But I think it's really this sort of philosophical head-to-head that's taking place at the moment that is absolutely fascinating and is not being, broadly speaking, talked about. Partly because you get buried in jargon and acronyms and the rest of it, and it's actually quite difficult to understand. So what I'm trying to do is to essentially shake all of that off and write it down in a way which you and I can understand.
Michael, I don't know how to sign off. I don't know what your business card, your digital business card would be. I've got a picture of you here on WhatsApp. So you're a fisherman. You're a contributor to the Daily Maverick. You're a fisherman. But what else are you?
At the moment, I'm really starting to think deeply about what's actually happening in the global economy. And I'm going back to history. I'm reading a lot into sort of strange areas. The latest thing is the something called the Heartland Theory, which I think is being reinvoked by the Chinese and was done so in Shanghai last week. Or sorry, not Shanghai, Tianjin. And Beijing to some extent when they had their big parades. But basically it's bringing together all the Asians into one big group, one big, and Xi Jinping even uses the phrase family. Hmm. And the idea of seeing, the Russians, the Indians and the Chinese glad-handing each other in Tianjin should have made people woken up. This is a really big shift. And that's sort of what I'm concentrating on at the moment.
So you're a thinker as well. Michael, thank you very much for your time. Michael Power will be back very soon with an AI expose. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of Lindsay Williams and various contributors and do not reflect the policy, position, or opinion of any other agency, organization, employer, or company associated with strictlybusinesspodcast.com. Assumptions made on the analyses are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the speaker or the author. And since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity.